From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore whether America is ready to elect its first Black female president. Then we'll look at why Milwaukee's population has declined since the pandemic.
When the pandemic began, there was a real movement out of cities. Part of the deal of living in a city is, you know, you might have less personal space, but in exchange you have access to all these great amenities. During the shutdown, those amenities weren't there, so I think quality of life really declined.
Plus, we'll go behind the scenes at the Milwaukee Public Museum and learn about a rare painting.
It's a phenomenal record before photography. It's very rare to have this, and especially a group portraits.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll examine why Milwaukee's population is shrinking, despite Mayor Cavalier Johnson's goal of growing it to 1 million people. But first, the Democratic Party has seen a momentum shift since President Joe Biden decided to end his reelection bid and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. That momentum has continued this week with the Democratic National Convention underway in Chicago. The change in candidates has brought a big change to the top of the ticket. Kamala Harris is the first Black female nominee for a major presidential party. And that sparked examinations over her identity and candidacy. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell is joined by Dr. Wendy Smooth to discuss Harris's historic campaign and its potential impact, and if America is ready for a Black woman president.
We've had African-American women involved deeply in American politics, whether we think of them as high propensity voters, where in 2008, 2012, Black women outvoted every other group in the electorate. A lot of people say, well, that was Obama's election. And so, of course, people showed up in record numbers. But that was actually part of a trend that scholars like myself have been watching over the years in terms of increased mobilization by African-American women. So African-American women have been engaged as voters. Even prior to that high engagement as voters, they've been engaged as participators in civic life. So you have people like Fannie Lou Hamer and her role in opening the Democratic Party convention to more representation of Americans serving as delegates in the convention. We have to point back to all of the Black women suffragists who participated in pushing for women to acquire the right to vote, though themselves turned out not to have full access to the ballot. So there's so many various women I could point out across history who have contributed to this historic moment. So I just say all of that to say Black women are not new to American politics and to performing at high levels in terms of American electoral politics. We just haven't been very savvy about telling their stories and unpacking the richness of their contributions.
You know, you're talking about how historic this moment is, but also like Black women have been, you know, doing the work in politics for generations. So it is an exciting moment, but, you know, we're talking about Black women doing this work in America, right? A place where, I'm gonna quote Malcolm X, right? Where Black women are the most disrespected, unprotected, most neglected. You know, what do you see with Kamala being the Democratic nominee? Like what challenges she might face being on the national stage like this?
So sure, in terms of challenges, we've already started to see many of the challenges that we will, I think, can prepare to have it escalate as we get closer and closer to November. A lot of attacks that we're seeing map to questioning her intelligence, her competitor, Former President Trump has been very outspoken in terms of questioning her intelligence. Also questions about her identity and how she has lived her life, both culturally, lived her life, and how she has identified in terms of her race and ethnicity. So those are the kinds of questions we will continue to see. There's been even ways in which is an extraordinarily gendered way of engaging with the candidate. Is it seems as if it's a compliment, but it is one of the most backhanded compliments one could ever receive, is to call a candidate for a president a very beautiful woman. And we've seen that now several times from former President Trump. We've seen it from some of the operatives from the Republican Party. And why I say that is an undermined compliment is that it's a focus on superficial components of her identity without taking her seriously as a contender and taking her seriously as a candidate. So it is a strategy of undermining what she is bringing to the table as a candidate. So it's a deflection from her record, deflection from her years of experience as a public servant, and the many different levels of public service that she's contributed to the United States. And so those are the kinds that focus on appearance is something that women in politics have long had to combat. And it's also manifesting itself at this moment in presidential party history.
You mentioned that something that, you know, women have, you know, always had to deal with. Do you think when it comes to Black women who, you know, pursue these high positions, do you think they're affected in a different kind of way?
So, sure. So one of the things that we can expect to hear more of are all of the various ways that Harris is hypersexualized as a candidate. And we see that with women of color, especially African-American women running for a public office, in which we become very consumed with their dating life or with their history of their partners. And so, you know, there are these accusations that Harris somehow slept her way into the political limelight based on her previous relationships. And that's a very degrading way to speak about an experienced politician. We have not in the same way interrogated other candidates' romantic affairs, whether they were inside the context of their marriages or not. It doesn't tend to be stories that stick, but there's something about the traditional ways that we think of them as tropes, right? Traditional ways of thinking about African-American women. And so there are these ways of hypersexualizing African-American women as the Jezebel or the hypersexed matriarch, and all of these various ways that we as a society have often degraded and framed African-American women. And politicians don't escape that, unfortunately. Those tropes travel with them onto the political scene. And I think we'll see more and more of those kinds of stories surface because they have a bit of resonance with the way that we as Americans tend to think anyway. So when those themes start to pop up, we've got to take a pause and say, why is this a part of the story? Why is this an important component of the story? Why does someone feel the need to tell me this as a member of the voting populace? Why is this being shared with me? And it's designed to trigger a particular thought process in us. And so we have the power to disrupt that by calling it out and then also questioning ourselves in terms of what that makes us think about.
So the way that, you know, Kamala might be spoken about, whether, you know, her being hypersexualized, questioning her identity and, you know, her qualifications for the position, I wonder how you think those comments that are coming toward Kamala, like how that would affect everyday Black women?
Absolutely. The Sunday when it was announced that President Biden would not be moving forward and that he would endorse Kamala Harris, my first thought was buckle up, every Black woman, buckle up, because so much of the vitriol that she is experiencing is not only directed towards her as a candidate, but for Black women in leadership, no matter what sector you're in, whether you are the high school principal, the college president, the nursing supervisor, all of those kinds of negative attacks that we hear related to Kamala Harris's leadership, attacks on her identity, can be collectively felt by African American women, no matter where you are in terms of your sector that you're working in or your professional life and your day-to-day actions on the street. When she is attacked in the ways that she's attacked, it's meaningful for all Black women. And so my instinct to say, buckle up, here it comes, is that I realized what we were about to hear and what we would begin to hear. And so when we question her leadership, we question her experience and we question her intellect, that has a riveting effect in terms of how we question all Black women, because there is a part, there is a way that those ideas resonate with those who we are around constantly. And I speak of that as a Black woman working in the education sector and see these things all the time.
Why does Kamala's race and gender matter, particularly in the role of, you know, president?
One thing, I think back to the night that she and Joe Biden accepted the election results. And she made a comment that she may be the first, but she wouldn't be the last, right? So there's a historic, groundbreaking nature of her vice presidency. So we have to start there, right? I watched that moment with my young daughter, whose eyes lit up, right? With Kamala Harris coming into this amazing moment as a leader. So there's all of this kind of cultural importance. So if you think about the impact of her as the vice president, think about the impact of her as the president in terms of what young people will understand as their possibilities. And that's possibilities for girls and for our young men alike, to see that possibility of a woman's leadership being respected and represented around the world as this is what America produces. That is a historic and amazing thing. So that aside, that's huge. The other component that's so incredibly important about this moment is that with Harris coming forth as a candidate for the president, should she win the presidency, it's not only her identity that we get an opportunity to focus on. We'll begin to hear even more about the issues and the policies that she is bringing forth. Oftentimes, candidates bring forth policies that are based on their experiences, their lived experiences, the experiences of those around them. So it's no surprise that Kamala Harris has already started to talk about price gouging in terms of groceries and everyday essentials, right? Because she's not coming from a life of extraordinary wealth. Right? She's coming from a life of everyday parents who actually had to buy groceries, right? Didn't have anyone to go and get them on their behalf, right? But they were actually, you know, everyday shoppers. She's talking about these issues around women's reproductive health. And that is an issue that hits for women of all ages in terms of thinking about quality of life, right? And so as we see more of those kinds of issues or her platform come forth over the next week, we also get an opportunity to see what does it mean for someone with a non-traditional background, non-traditional collection of experiences having lived an African American and South Asian experience in this country, what will her policies look like that are different than what we traditionally see? And we're already starting to see the chatter of that. So while we get excited, and of course we get excited about the historic moment and her identity, we also have to think about how her identity informs her politics and informs the issues and the platform that she will pursue.
Going back to the original question of why I reached out to you, I was asking, was America ready for its first Black woman president? And then I started to see like there were a number of other articles like media asking that question. And I wonder, why do you think that that's a question that so, you know, much of media is asking?
Absolutely. It is. It's a great question. Are we ready? Right? This is something new. We have to acknowledge the newness of the moment. And there is a lot of excitement. But we do have to ask this question is when voters are alone one-to-one, will they pull a lever in support of an African-American woman? So to take this step into history, this newness. And I think one of the things that we have to kind of pull back, right, and say it's not so much, yeah, it's a great moment for American history. But again, I go back to the policies and the ways in which this is a defining moment for democracy with a small d, right? And our role as voters in thinking about the state of democracy and democratic values. So the readiness, right, is also about your readiness to accept the alternative.
Dr. Wendy Smooth is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a rare portrait at the Milwaukee Public Museum. But first, we'll look at some data about Milwaukee's population. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The latest population numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau are out. The estimates show that Milwaukee's population is still shrinking, but at a slightly slower pace. The data shows the city's population fell after the pandemic, and recovery from that has yet to begin. Despite Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson's ambitious goal to grow the city's population to 1 million people. To learn about this continuous population decline, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by John Johnson, a research fellow at Marquette University's Lubar Center.
Before we jump in, what's the data that you looked at to gather all of this information?
Yeah, I think everyone's familiar with the census that happens every 10 years when the government tries to count everybody. But, you know, that data is out of date by the time it gets released. And especially this time, the census officially took place on April 1st, 2020. And so it missed really all the changes from the pandemic. So it's really interesting to look at these annual population estimates that the Census Bureau also releases. And they get those by trying to really carefully count births, deaths, and then where people are moving. Often when you move it, you end up changing your address with some kind of federal program, the IRS, Social Security, Medicare, those kinds of things. And so pulling many different data sources together, the Census Bureau releases these population estimates as of July 1st of each year. And so the most recent numbers are as of July 1st, 2023, measuring the change that occurred between July 1st, 2022 and 2023.
So what stood out to me from your report is that Milwaukee County's population continues to decline. You note that it's a slower decline compared to recent years, but it's still shrinking at twice the rate of the 2010s. Can you help explain that shift?
Yeah, the city's population and the county's population, I believe, have fallen in every census beginning in 1970. We think the city was actually growing from the mid-aughts, so like, you know, like 2005-ish through the early 2010s. But when you look at those 10-year benchmarks, it's been declining consistently. And that was true from 2010 to 2020, although actually the census showed that the number of occupied housing units grew by about 5,000, but the city's population fell by about 17,000 from 2010 to 2020 because household size shrank. Then when the pandemic hit, that really hammered cities across the country, and particularly Milwaukee. The population of the city shrank a lot in that first year of the pandemic, and then a little bit less the year after, but then it was still shrinking in 2023, even as other parts of the country were beginning to recover.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm wondering, is there anything that can help explain that shift?
Well, I think several factors. When the pandemic began, there was a real movement out of cities, I think, for easy to understand reasons. You know, people wanted more space. Part of the deal of living in a city is, you know, you might have less personal space, a smaller apartment or a smaller house, but in exchange, you have access to all these great amenities. During the shutdown, those amenities weren't there. So I think quality of life really declined in cities for a lot of people. And then also in Milwaukee, we had three really bad years where we set sequential record numbers for murders in the city. And I think it's no surprise that that, you know, encouraged some people to leave.
So basically what I'm hearing from what you're explaining to me is that Milwaukee County is seeing more births than deaths, but more people are choosing to move away. Is this true for the city of Milwaukee, too?
Yes, and it's more true for the city than it is for the county as a whole.
Interesting.
So, yeah, the suburbs have a little bit of a different thing going on.
Yeah, tell me about what the population is going on in the suburbs, like Oak Creek, maybe.
Yeah, Oak Creek is growing, and it's growing in large part by adding more housing units and having more people move there. I think it also has a pretty strong birth rate as well, although that data is a little bit harder to get. Milwaukee City, on the other hand, has this relatively strong birth rate, but more people leave than move here, as you said. Although it's worth pointing out that the birth rate in Milwaukee has been declining. The number of births to mothers in the city has been going down over the last decade or so, and that decline accelerated during the pandemic. Whereas the trend in the suburbs has been more flat. So the number of babies being born in the Milwaukee County suburbs has stayed pretty level over the last couple decades. Consequently, the share of babies being born in the county has actually shifted towards the suburbs, even though the majority are still born within city limits.
So I guess I'm curious, what about rural areas? I feel like sometimes the story is people are leaving rural places. What's going on over there?
Yeah, it varies between the states in an interesting way. Rural Illinois is really getting slammed. There are a lot of places in rural Illinois that have more deaths than births and more people leaving than coming there, which is really kind of a double whammy that's hard to recover from. If you look in rural Wisconsin, there's actually this, to me, fascinating band of population growth from northern Michigan through northern Wisconsin and into northern Minnesota, really the sort of North Woods area. And what we see is that, you know, the population is pretty old up there, so there's actually more deaths than births in most places. But over the last few years, there's been a pronounced increase in migration to those counties, mostly domestic migration, people moving from somewhere else in the United States to there to live. And I wonder if some of that is remote work allowing people who maybe have wanted the kind of lifestyle you can have in northern Wisconsin, which is very pleasant in a lot of ways, but didn't have a job that would let them move there beforehand. That's some speculation on my part. We'll get, you know, the sort of data that lets us measure that better in the future. But certainly the population trends we've seen since the pandemic are consistent with that.
That's really interesting. And so I'm thinking we're seeing the story play out of Milwaukee shrinking. But the mayor, when he was running to become Milwaukee's mayor in 2022, Cavalier Johnson, said he wants the city's population to grow to 1 million people. But we're far from that. So I wonder, can the city government actually do that? Like, what power do they have over population change?
Right. I think fortunately, this is America. The government can't make you move to Milwaukee. They can't make you have more kids. So, you know, there's limits. And I applaud the mayor's enthusiasm for Milwaukee. And I think there's strong reasons to want the city to grow. Namely, the city was built for a lot more people. And so we have this sort of built environment and fixed infrastructure that right now fewer of us are having to pay for. And so actually it helps us sort of shoulder the burden of the infrastructure we've got to have more people living here. The mayor's efforts to grow the population that I've seen thus far are the sorts of things that will bear fruit over the longer term. He's focused a lot to date on trying to get the reckless driving problem in the city under control, particularly through changing the design of streets to encourage safer driving and to make it safe for people to get around in ways that aren't driving. And that's a quality of life change that I think can make the city more attractive in its way. He's currently promoting a change to the zoning code, which would make it easier to build accessory dwelling units and small apartment buildings around the city, which could have the effect of increasing the housing supply in some of these popular neighborhoods where there aren't a lot of empty lots currently. That proposal, I believe, will be voted on by the Common Council later this year. I think it's a great idea, honestly, and could make some real changes in the city over time, but it's not the new policy yet. And the mayor's also begun talking this year about needing to improve the quality of education that's in the city, because when you talk to especially young families, you see that that's a big concern for them, is the quality of education. And in fact, you can kind of measure that effect by looking at the number of babies that are born in the city mm-hmm. in a given year, and then seeing what the enrollment in first grade is 6 years later. So I've looked at this across all sectors, district schools, charter schools, private schools, and you see about a 19% drop in the number of kids going on to enroll in first grade compared to birth. So that means that nearly a fifth of young families are choosing to move out of the city after their child is born and before they enroll in school.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that's sort of a group of people you can look at and be like, okay, why are they leaving? How do we make the city more attractive for them to stay in. Part of that is education. Part of that is providing the sort of housing that they want to live in, quality of life issues. And I think we see that those are top of mind for this mayoral administration.
So what else can be done to bring people to Milwaukee, but also keep them here, like you mentioned?
Provide the kind of housing that will increase the population in the neighborhoods that people want to live in. So, you know, we see neighborhoods where housing prices go up because housing is scarce, and we see other neighborhoods where as we build new housing units, they fill up. I don't think there's a single place in the city where we've added a lot of housing units and have high vacancy rates. Anytime we build more housing, people move into those units. And I sometimes hear people say, like, why are we only building these one-bedroom apartments or studios, these small kinds of places? And the reason is that even as we've built a lot of those small apartment buildings, the city has added one-person households much faster than we've been able to build those. So the demand is actually there. There's a lot of people living by themselves who, as best we can tell, will choose a smaller place to live in a neighborhood that they want to live in, given the choice to do so. So I think there's a supply issue and then also this quality of life issue we've discussed, the parts of the city that it's difficult to have a safe, healthy lifestyle. And so people often leave when they're able to.
Well, John, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate you sharing your insight with me and making sense of Milwaukee's population.
My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. He spoke with Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez. You can hear more of this conversation at WUWM.com. The Milwaukee Public Museum has more than 4 million artifacts in its collections. Many of those items either haven't been displayed or have only been viewable during certain exhibitions. As part of our series Behind the Scenes at MPM, we'll examine one of those unseen items today. It's a rare painting called Menominee Women and depicts a group of Native American women. Dawn Cher Tomei is the museum's anthropology curator, and she says it's a rare record of how Native women used European goods. Cher Tomei met with me and WUWM's Eddie Morales to share more about the artifact.
Are there any items here that haven't been displayed before that you plan to display in the future museum?
Yeah, I mean, some of the ones that we have on the table here, this particular piece was on temporary display just for a little while in a couple of exhibits. I love this painting. It's called Menominee Women, so it is also Wisconsin. It was made by an artist named Samuel Brooks in 1858, so before photography was prominent. And so it's very unusual also to have images of women, you know, at that time that were painted. So it's a wonderful record for the Menominee tribe to have this. And it shows exactly what they were wearing at the time, which is a combination of traditional clothing and also using trade items like ribbons and trade blankets, for example. And anyway, it's phenomenal. And it's got a pair. It's part of a pair. There's a Menominee men's painting as well. So, but one of the hidden features is that he recorded the men's names and the women's names are not present, which is actually par for the course during that time. Very kind of a Eurocentric perspective because women were not obviously as important in their eyes.
In the eyes of the Europeans who were creating this.
Exactly, yes. I mean, even though, you know, you have some tribes that are matrilineal, and they are the ones, you know, that the women are more of the political leaders, they wouldn't talk to them. They would only talk to the men, which was very disruptive. But anyway, it's really an exceptional painting, and I'm very excited that it's going to be on exhibit. So it's not a focus for our museum to have, or we didn't really focus on fine art in that sense. When you go to the history department, you'll see some, but it was more happenstance because we had been here decades before our historical society was founded. And so we were also kind of like the historical society for Milwaukee. So we have a lot of local material you might not find in a, you know, a nationally focused or globally focused natural history museum.
Can you describe just like the size of it and what the depiction is for listeners?
Yeah, so it's maybe 3 feet by 3.5 feet, mm-hmm. and with a wood frame, and it's there's a painting of five women, and then two gentlemen here who are leaning. So the women are in the forefront, and that's really the focus, and the men are leaning against a tree. What I find really fascinating, and I use this interpretively, is that actually these men would have been further back, but he decided to bring them forefront because they're watching him. They're not letting him alone with women because it takes a long time to paint. And so he brought them forefront, but you could see the men's expression are saying, I don't trust you. So it's very clear in the painting what they're communicating.
And it must have been restored, right?
Yes. We did not have this originally, the men's painting we had for several decades. This actually came from an estate in California. So Samuel Brooks actually went to California after he left Wisconsin. And we didn't know this painting even existed. We only knew about the Menominee men painting and some other paintings he did, which reside in the Historical Society. And so we were contacted by an estate. And they said, we're contacting you because you're a museum in Wisconsin, and this is Menominee, and that Menominee reside here. And said, we have this painting by Samuel Brooks that's called Menominee Women. But it was in horrible, horrible condition. And so we were very fortunate to work with a local individual who was a fine arts aficionado. And he loaned us the money to purchase it as well as the restoration. We were able to work with another foundation for the actual restoration. But it was in horrible condition. But like I said, it's a phenomenal record before photography. It's very rare to have this, and especially a group portraits, because you probably have seen, you have, here's a picture of a guy, you know, this a famous, you know, a mayor, a governor, a soldier, but these are not quite as common. The restoration, you could see that in the picture that you're looking at is some of the degradation of the painting, and it's very yellow and cracked, and even some of the faces are not discernible. It took many, many hours. We did not do it on site. We had a specialist work on it. But also the yellowing was not just the paint, but it wasn't glassed apparently. And so whoever was doing that was smoking as well. So it just had a lot of damage, you know, where it resided before in California. But we were excited to bring it home.
It is fascinating to see the two paintings juxtaposed because it's so clearly the same setting.
Mm-hmm. And he must have really liked this one to take it with him. You know, that's all I can say, that the artist resonated more with him than the other painting, which stayed here. So, and he was asked to do this by a benefactor. And at that time, oftentimes painters would have people who would ask them to paint certain things, a landscape. That's how they made their money. they would have a benefactor. And so he had one, that actually paid him to paint these.
It's interesting to have a child pictured as well.
Yeah, there is a young girl here, and all of them are young women. We hope to. It would be nice if we could find their names. That is something that we would like to do. We're not sure, and we have been talking to the Menominee Nation. We do consultation with all of the different tribes in Wisconsin for our future museum, and so they're helping us select cultural heritage items for the new museum, helping us tell their stories. So it's been exciting work. And so this is something that we hope that we can provide, you know, their identity back to them.
If you can speak to this, how has that changed over the years of just collaboration with different Native nations and coming into not only in like contemporary times here with this museum, but also with the future museum? How's that changed over the years?
Well, I mean, you cannot do that anymore. You know, you can't just put a culture on exhibit without consultation or working with the source community, because they're the knowledge bearers, you know, that, so it's really very important to have their voices because it is their culture. You know, it is residing here. That's why I use that term, you know, that we don't own it in the traditional sense. So it's really critical because the story is also so much richer. And so you want to work with the people who have the knowledge.
And then in the future museum, that's an extra effort going forward to make sure that they are involved in that?
Very much so. And it takes years. And we're collaborating with people from all across the world.
Dawn Cher Tomei is the anthropology curator at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke to me and WUWM's Eddie Morales for our series Behind the Scenes at MPM. You can find more about that at WUWM.com. Neighborhood beauty is something that is often overlooked as an aspect of health. Coming up next, we'll visit a community garden that takes beauty seriously by inviting students to create art and infrastructure to supplement the fresh produce and flowers already growing there. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When you think of the Housing Authority of Milwaukee, you probably think of, well, housing. But one Housing Authority lot is serving a different purpose, neighborhood beautification. Located near 23rd and Cherry Street in the Midtown neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side, Cherry Street Community Garden is a place for residents to connect to their agricultural roots and nurture beauty. Cherry Street Garden has been a place for area residents, many living in adjacent Housing Authority property, to gather amongst food and art. Lake Effect Sam Woods visited the garden last year to learn how it was founded and what it has become.
In a city of concrete, nicknamed after cream-colored bricks, keeping a connection to your family's agricultural roots might seem impossible, or at least impractical. But Santana Webb is finding a way. Now, she's only a freshman in high school, but she has been growing food next to her Midtown neighborhood home for over 10 years, together with her grandmother, Linda. Now, I visited her garden plot recently, and let me tell you, she beams with pride when she tells me about everything she's growing, from the tomatoes to the jalapenos, the peppers, the beans, all of it. But she also is reflective about how nurturing these crops helps her connect to her family's southern roots.
My mom and my grandmother was actually raised in the South, so they make fried green tomatoes every now and then, and tomatoes are just great. And then the collards, my mom and my grandmother, when they were in the South, they used to let the frost hit them first, and then they would pick them because they taste better like that, and they're more like tender and stuff. So, and then she stores them in freezer bags so she could use them for like holidays like New Year's Eve, Christmas. Sometimes she cooks them on Easter, so just like special events.
And while Santana is the one connecting to family traditions established in previous generations, she actually played a big role in getting her family gardening again after they moved to Milwaukee. Originally starting in the Cherry Street Garden with her grandmother as a child, she slowly brought more and more of her family across the parking lot from their home to dig into the soil and develop their roots.
Basically, after like the first or second year of gardening, I went back to my mother and I was telling her about it, and like I was so eager. Like my mom, she knew that I really liked it. So I asked her, would she start coming out and get a garden for me? And so we could have our own garden. And she was like, all right. She was like, I'll try it. And so she started coming with me and my grandmother. And basically, once we got her out, we got my other grandmother out. And since then, everyone has been gardening.
Stories like these bring a smile to Lisa Ruskowski's face. In 2012, Lisa and her husband Rick founded Cherry Street Garden, built on land owned by the Housing Authority and operated by Bloom MKE, a nonprofit that manages the garden, in addition to providing gardening education programs and even little free library book drives. The garden was named for its proximity to Cherry Street in Milwaukee's Midtown neighborhood. But the cherry trees that line the garden's borders today would coincidentally come later.
Yeah, this garden's really blossomed over the last 10, 12 years. So we started with 19 raised beds. We've now grown to 33, plus a few little spot gardens to kind of highlight some additional growing techniques. And then in 2015, the city put in an orchard space here. So we have cherry trees growing at Cherry Street Garden.
Makes sense.
And then I think we're actually the only orchard that got the cherry trees that year. So we're very happy to have those.
They probably saw your application on the grant. Like, well, we have to give it to them, right?
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular also. The cherry trees are incredibly productive. Anybody and everybody should come by and pick those in July because we have plenty to share.
All right.
And then we have the apple trees, which are just coming into bloom now, or into harvest time now, making some amazing apple cider out here in the garden, a few different events. So we've grown both in the number of beds we have as well as having the orchard. And we've also refurbished a lot of our beds from being the original 8-inch high beds to being more accessible 24-inch beds, because more than half the gardeners here are older or elderly and or physically disabled. So our goal is for people to be able to easily reach into their bed, to be fully participating in the garden experience.
Yeah, and so on that note of the gardeners who are here, the people who are gardening here, I see names on a lot of these beds, right? And from talking to some of the gardeners, my understanding is that a lot of them live in the surrounding area, right?
Correct. So almost everybody who gardens here lives within walking distance. So either they live a block over at the Cherry Court Apartments, which is the Housing Authority building, or there's our surrounding neighborhoods, neighbors, which is great. Keeps a lot of eyes on the garden, keeps people walking over and engaged. And, you know, and this, you know, this is classified as a food desert. So it's really nice to have a space here where healthy food's getting grown. We have a couple beds that we plant just to share with neighbors, so that even if you don't buy in and have a bed and are one of the garden club members, you're still welcome here.
Lisa and Rick established this garden for a very tangible purpose: access to healthy food in a food desert.
Over time, though, the garden has served additional intangible purposes, like connecting Santana and her family to their southern roots, and recently, becoming a place where beauty is celebrated. At first, this meant flowers on the grounds. Natural for a garden, right? Bloom MKE received a grant to get some public art in the garden. They went straight to gardeners for ideas, who came back to them with ideas on how to celebrate the community that was building there, as well as to serve a functional purpose, like benches that are easy for people with mobility issues to get into and out of, as well as a shade station held up by totems designed by local students, as well as murals to celebrate the gardeners there. Altogether, these pieces are helping the garden function as a gathering place, both for pollinators and for people.
I firmly believe that every neighborhood in this city deserves beauty. And so to me, as a total gardener geek, to me that was flowers. To me that was having the beauty of the natural surroundings. But then when we had this opportunity to get this community challenge grant from the Joy Engine Project, they gave us, you know, the money and the founding and honestly the inspiration to say, hey, what else could you do here? And it has been out of this world transformational to me. As beautiful as it is, it's just a whole nother level now that there's art in the space. So they gave us this grant in the summer of 2022. And in the fall, we started meeting with gardeners and doing listening sessions and saying, what would you want to see? And some themes came out really strongly. One was the gardeners felt that this is a space that's important for community building and community gathering. So they wanted to see more seating. They wanted to see some shade. I mean, you know, none of us love sitting out in the hot sun, but especially if, you know, if you're elderly or if you're on some, you know, blood pressure medications, that hot sun can be dangerous. So we had the idea of part of the art could be this shade oasis that we're sitting in right now. And so, you know, we have the shade sail above us, but then instead of just having posts in the ground, we have these totems that were designed by Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design students and then carved by University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee architecture students. So we have these carved totem posts holding up the shade sail. And then we have these amazing benches that were designed by the architecture students and built by them. And they are creative and comfortable, glad to say.
Yeah, for
sure. So it's been really amazing to have this little oasis right in the middle of the garden. So you can sit here and look out at your plants and enjoy the natural beauty and be very comfortable doing that. But then if you look around at the five different mural projects that are in here, it just blows my mind. Each one was done by a different Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design or a MIED student or a group of students. But what you see is that they really heard from the listening sessions that we shared with them how important it was to that the garden talk about family, that it talk about legacy and the legacy of agriculture for people moving up from the South, and as well as the sense of community they wanted to feel in this space. So when you look at these pieces, they're all unique and different. The artists have totally different styles, but you absolutely feel that sense of groundedness and community and family and how important the agricultural roots that this community has, even though they're now living in urban settings. And so to me, each piece really powerfully speaks for itself.
One of those MIAD design students that Lisa mentioned is Isaac Pulliam. He met Lisa and Rick through the school's service learning program, and he was immediately drawn to the project. He listened to stories about Santana and her grandmother and knew he wanted to feature them in a mural that he would create for the garden.
Well, when we heard about this opportunity, it was in the middle of winter, so there wasn't much action here in the garden. So
we don't really go outside in the winter.
Yeah. So basically, I just got a whole lot of photos from Lisa of Santana and her family, and I just created a Photoshop composition of the different photos that I had from them.
Now, Isaac is a humble guy, and he's not one to talk himself up, and believe me, I tried to get him to do so, because this is a beautiful piece. Beautiful in just a matter-of-fact, everyday slice-of-life kind of sense. It captures Santana and her grandmother carrying their harvest home amidst a backdrop of cherry trees and fruiting tomatoes. When you look at the mural, it's as if Santana just noticed you standing there, while her grandmother just looks ready to get home and fry some fresh tomatoes after a long day harvesting. And Isaac is happy with how the piece turned out, but he's also happy with where it ended up. He sees gardens as a natural place for the visual arts to live, because he sees gardeners as artists who have a similar process to muralists like himself, but just happen to use soil as their medium instead of paint.
it's a good feeling to be part of this community, and especially being in a community of gardeners, there's a lot of connections that go hand in hand with gardening and art, especially like from beginning to end. Deciding out, you got to planning out like the process, you got to plan out everything, like how you're going to apply everything, what materials you have to use that gets put into everything, and you don't really know how it's going to turn out until it's a finished product.
After spending about an hour in the garden with Santana, Lisa, and Isaac, it felt like an extended exhale. More than a breath of fresh air, Cherry Street is a reminder of how beautiful our city can be when we take the time to nurture and appreciate it. For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
The Cherry Street Community Garden is located near 23rd and Cherry Street and is managed by Bloom MKE, a nonprofit organization that uses gardening to foster community engagement. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at a new book called Anti-Democratic and learn about partisan politics impacting Wisconsinites. Plus, we'll tell you about some of the best places to visit dunes in and around Wisconsin. That's all tomorrow at noon right here on Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.